So welcome to A Correction Podcast. I'm your host, Lev Moscow. And today I'm excited to be joined by Gianluca Russo, who is a postdoctoral fellow at Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona. He holds a PhD in economics from Boston University, and his research interests lie at the intersection of political economy, development economics, and economic history. So welcome to the show, Gianluca.
Thank you, Lev. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm very excited for today's show. You co-authored a paper where you asked the question, what can we learn from the interwar experience about the character and dangers posed by the new resurgence of right-wing populism? And you really focus in this paper on Italian fascism.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And there have been some famous works about, you know, with the thesis that fascists in Italy got their support from an elite in Italy, which had not previously supported them, but had instead previously supported the center-right party. But your work, this paper, is different because there had never been empirical evidence to prove
right.
That. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what that thesis said and then how you went about proving it.
There's a bunch of historical narratives floating around that essentially claim that the rise of socialism and the fear of a socialist overtake of the government, of the Italian state, but in general in Europe, because you have to think about this historical period, it's the culmination of the Russian Revolution, right? So everybody in Europe is fearing that the same is going to happen to their own country, and Italy is no exception to this. And so during this same period, after World War I, the Socialist Party is very close to the socialist positions in Russia. And so this creates this external threat where the right wing, the usual elites on the right, they do not believe anymore that the classic right wing parties would be able to, you know, limit the advance of this socialist threat. And so this is where essentially the role of the local elites come in, because they start supporting and financing to some extent the rise of the fascist party, which is a far more right-wing extremist version of the old center-right parties. And so essentially this is what we try to test in our empirical fashion, which as you mentioned is to the best of our knowledge is one of the first times where we're really trying to get empirical evidence on the Red Scare and the rise of the role of the Red Scare in explaining the rise of fascism. And we collect data on the military effort of Italy and generate this look at the shock that World War I military casualty caused on Italy and the subsequent rise of socialism, and how this bolstered the support for right-wing fascism after 1922.
This may seem like a sort of an obvious question, but was there a relationship between the regions that lost lots of men in World War I and the success of the Socialist Party in, say, 1919?
So, yes. Yeah, so essentially what we find, the first thing that we bring evidence on is that more deaths from World War I led to higher support of for the Socialist Party in 1919. And we think that this is driven by all this negative effect, both economic, but in general, like the discontent that the Italian population felt after World War I. All of this negative effect brought to the increase of the support for the Socialist Party in 1919. Also because the Socialist Party was the only party that during the war throughout the whole war was against the participation of Italy in World War I. And so, this is exactly what we find in the data. Mm-hmm.
And then how do you measure right-wing support for the fascists? I imagine that would be very hard. And what kind of historical records did you have to...
Right. So this is the data that you can look up here is really, it's not really easy to get at. And there is some electoral data that we could leverage that essentially allows us to look at whether in 1924, what is the vote share for the fascist party and for the other parties it's always in 1924, but we can also look at this in 1921, although the vote share for the fascist party is not singled out because you have only this vote for the right-wing bloc. So that's why we focus on 1924 electoral vote share as our main outcome. But we had to do a lot of data collection. We had to go back to archives around Italy and search in newspapers to get more and more data on missing municipalities. So this electoral data I was mentioning has, say, Italy has approximately 8,000 municipalities. There was only information about the half of these municipalities. And so we were able to complement this and to get approximately around 5,000 municipalities information. And then we explained this in the paper, but we focus only on the center and the north of the country for historical, well, in the south of the country, basically socialist movement were non-existing. That's why we focus on that. And so we also collect data on fascist violences and on the creation of local branches of the fascist party in 1921. So also this data, we had to go back to archival records to make sure to find data for the whole country. Because in previous research, this was only collected at the provincial level, but also another improvement we're doing here is that we're going down to the municipality level, which is the most disaggregated administrative unit in Italy.
What did you end up finding?
And so we find that World War I essentially increased the vote share and the support for the Socialist Party, which we interpret as this rise of this socialist threat across Italian municipalities. And then we find that the socialist threat is the reason why fascist vote share increased in 1924. So we interpret this as evidence that the socialist threat is the main cause of the rise of the fascist party, of the rise of the consensus for the fascist party in 1924. We also find that socialist threat, higher vote share for the socialists in 1919 explains the rise of local branch for the fascist party and more violence between socialists and fascists in the early 1920s.
So how do you know that, say, some of the soldiers who are coming back from the war are not voting for the socialists in 1919 and then switching parties in 1924. Do the records show that it's not them who are switching parties, but it's actually the elite which are moving from the center right to the far right?
So we don't find evidence that there's a lot that veterans are driving these effects. We have some measures of veterans and they do not explain our main result. On the other hand, we don't find a lot of evidence that it's the socialists that are switching. It's the vote share of socialists that is reducing in 1924. What we see is the reduction in other parties' vote shares, and there is a coalescence of the support of the center-right parties around the fascist party, rather than, say, socialists that were unsatisfied from the socialist party in 1920s and then switched towards the fascist. Because we find that socialist vote share in 1919 does not predict a decrease in the socialist vote share in 1924.
Mm-hmm. And how do you know that it's the elites which are driving this?
Well, we have some data on it's not just the elite. We find that where the elites are present, this effect is magnified. But this effect is also present where, on average, without looking at differential effect, whether there is an elite or there is not an elite. But we see that especially where landowners elite are present, this effect on vote share and on violence and branches is magnified. So it interacts positively with the socialist vote share in 1919. To measure this, we collected data on the presence of these large landowners or local or so-called local elites.
The socialists, well, they don't really deserve much of the blame on some level for this. They just successful in 1919, and their very success is what's driving the rise of fascism. But on another level, you know, one, I guess, could make the argument if they hadn't been so close, if they hadn't moved so close to the Soviet Union, maybe there wouldn't have been, you know, much the propaganda on the right would have fallen flat because it wouldn't have actually, there wouldn't have been a Red Scare. So what's your take on that?
No, I think that there's no blame to be put on socialists. I mean, socialists were being socialists at that point. I think that I personally find here's to blame is the lack of the Italian state that not really being present at a local level and wasn't preventing the fascist party to essentially manipulate the local. So we find that there's a lot of coercion going on in these countrysides where there are more socialists, local landowners get they couple up with the fascist thugs, and they systematically beat up the socialists. And we find that, I mean, my impression is that this is completely, if state was present, if, you know, the rule of law was present, this would have been possible. And, you know, it would not be unreasonable to think that Italy after World War I would have been better off if we would have listened to the socialist demands. You know, at the end of the day, these people were just looking for the distribution of land. You know, like, instead what happened, instead of listening to their demands, they just shifted to the most conservative things in order to shut them off completely.
One of the funny things about your paper is you show that greater rainfall, perhaps, as well as the Spanish flu, may have led to more support in the 1919 election for the socialists. Can you explain what you think is happening?
So there we're just trying to find corroborative evidence that anything that brings on the rise to the socialist party, so discontent, which might be driven by, you know, the lack of rainfall, so droughts, or as the other example is the increase of the 1919 influenza. So both things could have a positive effect on socialism, because we think that those are negative economic shocks. And, you know, after the war, the socialists were one of the first mass parties that could, you know, manage the grievances of the Italian population. And so we want to check that these negative shocks has a positive effect on fascism only through the rise of the Socialist Party in 1919. So essentially it's another way to test the Red Scare hypothesis without using the data on military deaths. And, you know, the data is not as good, it's not as granular as the data we have for the military deaths. So we don't find exactly the same pattern, especially in terms of precision, but we have suggestive evidence that there is a similar pattern also there.
You know, I can understand why the elites would lose faith in the center-right parties and move to the far right. But who else is exactly being scared in this Red Scare? Do we have a sense of, I mean, is it small business owners?
Well, you have to think about that. You have to think that in this time period, some of the requests of the Socialist Party were basically the redistribution of the means of production. It's basically anyone that has private property, and especially this was especially strong in the countryside, but also small owners in the cities, industrialists, they would be the one that would be the most scared, right? Because they would, if, you know, we want to achieve the collectivization of the means of production, well, they would lose all of their property. So it's clearly large industrialists and large landowners are the one that would lose the most out of this. But there's also like a widespread sentiment in the petty bourgeoisie that the rise of a socialist revolution would make them much worse off.
You know, I spent a lot of time I used to live in Florence, and I spent a lot of time in Tuscany. And
also, let me say, I noticed that the music that introduces the show is really appropriate for this
stuff. Yeah, right? it's true. It's Bella Ciao. Yeah, but you know, it's so Bella Ciao. That is, you know, only like Italians and people on the European left recognize it. A lot of times I have guests on who are like, oh, it sounds like Jewish klezmer music. it is Bella Ciao. I remember probably starting in around 2012, 2013, seeing lots of graffiti for Casa Pound, which was a right-wing, you know, these were for right-wing squat houses in Florence. But it surprised me because Florence has always been pretty left-wing city. And, you know, and then you start to see the rise of Salvini, you know, the years after.
Yeah.
And now we are where we are.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, because reading your paper, you know, again, it makes sense. There's a really strong showing in the 1919 election for the socialists, and then the right reacts as they do.
Yeah.
My sense of Italy today, we can talk about United States and Hungary and Brazil, but let's talk about Italy. You know, my sense wasn't that there was a strong socialist
right. No, you're right.
So how do we, you know, how do we understand what's happening today? Because it seems to me that so much of your paper really is trying to learn some lessons from the 20s.
I think there's a general lesson to be learned that it's not just about the socialist threat, but essentially the populism and right-wing extremism, they flourish when there is some sort of external threat that can be leveraged to increase the anxieties and fears in the population. And so, you know, like similarly today, we could think about a lot of things that are increasing these anxieties, like the Great Recession in 2007, and there's a lot of evidence out there that this has had a positive effect on the rise of populism in, you know, not just in Italy, but also in France and the rest of Europe. I mean, Brexit is an example, but also more recently, I was really sad to see how countries like even Hungary, which supposedly is in the European Union, is using the COVID-19 crisis to alter the fundamentals of democracy by diminishing the power as the parliamentary representation and so on. And so I think that there is this general pattern that we can learn on how right-wing and populist parties use this external threat to bolster their control of the government, and I think this, you know, the socialist threat is one big example that is really important for the 1920s. But you know, you're right. The Italian left has been dead for a while. I might say, unfortunately.
But so I guess if the Italian left is dead, how is it that the Italian right, again, in the 20s, they could say genuinely, look, the left is doing really well. How does it actually work today when there isn't the left? Do people in Italy still think that there's this like really strong socialist movement?
No, I think that what they might say is like, look, there's a lot of immigrants coming in, or there's a lot of, there's a lot of Chinese are like, you know, the competition on the China shock, like we are losing our manufacturing sector because we are allowing this competition. We should just close down, like close the barriers, or the immigrants are stealing your job. You know, vote for us, we will make Italy great again. That's kind of like the usual leitmotif of this right wing parties, but they all start with this external threat. Sometimes it might not even be true. You know, like in Italy we need migrants, so they use true or not true leitmotif to motivate to increase the fear of the population, and then when they're out there, they try to use it to get more electoral power, more electoral consent. So migration is just one of them, but you know, as I said, the Great Recession, you know, globalization in general. There's always this fear of the other, of the external, of something that is there upon us that is putting us in danger. And that, you know, like right wing is usually the order, security that will restore the security in the country. So I think that's the parallel that we can draw between what was going on in the 1920s and what is going on today, for example.
Gianluca, I don't know the answer to this, so maybe you can help me.
Yeah, I hope so.
So the Russian Revolution is 1917. And the Italian Communist Party is close to the Soviet Union. You know, it's one of the largest, after the war, one of the largest communist parties in Europe. I think it's either the first or the second behind France. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, after 89, the left goes through a bunch of changes, but eventually finds itself as the Democratic Party. It's a center-left party. And there really isn't a far left of the country at this point, as we talked about. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, does the socialist party and the strength of the Socialist Party in Italy, does it depend on there being a Soviet Union? Or was there a strong Socialist Party before 1917 in Italy?
So you're saying you're asking me if I think whether the fall of the Soviet Union had an effect on the fall of the Communist Party in Italy as well.
I'm asking that, and I'm asking it an even bigger question, which is it possible to have a strong socialist party without a strong socialist empire in the Soviet Union?
Right.
Because I'm thinking, you know, when there was a crisis, the crisis of World War I ended up actually helping the socialists. But the crisis of 08, the global financial crisis, did not. And I'm wondering if that's because there isn't a Soviet Union. I haven't asked anyone this question before. And I'm wondering in Italy whether or not you had a strong independent socialist Italian party before 1917.
Well, before 1917, yes, we had, the Socialist Party in Italy was founded a bit later than the rest of Europe. And, you know, in 1913, it's not as big as it will be after World War I, but it already has a good presence in the country. So I don't think that necessarily a Socialist Party needs the presence of the Soviet Union, especially because even after, you know, after World War II, if I remember correctly, the Italian Socialist Party was not leading off the commandments of the Soviet Union. And actually, if you would vote for the Socialist Party in Italy in the 1960, you were not voting for the collectivization of the means of production, while if you would vote for the Soviet Union, that's what they would recommend. And so I don't think that necessarily that there is these two things go together. However, it's true that radical left-wing parties, if you want to call it, like, you know, like communism, so or like radical socialism, nowadays are not it seems more that the anxieties and fears stemming of economic depression or, you know, in the influx of migrants is fueling this right-wing populism nowadays, unlike what happened maybe in Italy after World War One, where, you know, the economic shocks of the war had helped a lot the Socialist Party.
My last question is a question that I think students, whether they're high school students or university students, might be interested in. So you're a postdoctoral researcher, and you wrote this, you co-authored this paper with three other people, one of whom I recognize as you know, one of the biggest economists in the United States, Darren.
That is true.
And he's at MIT. And I'm just wondering, I'm curious, and it might be interesting for students of economics, how does someone, you know, you're pretty young, you're a postdoctoral researcher, you're doing great work, but how does someone like you link up with, you know, a world famous economist and write a paper?
Well, I mean, I was pretty lucky. I just had it turns out that we were working on the same things, and me separately from them. And so then when we found this out, we decided to join forces rather than competing with each other, because we realized that we were writing the same things up to some small differences. So it would have not made sense to compete with each other. In general, my suggestion would be just to, if you can, and if you can interact with, you know, I, for example, I did my PhD at Boston University, which is not, you know, MIT or Harvard, but still is a very good school. But one thing that I constantly did when I was in Boston was try to get in touch with people, for example, at Harvard, talk to as many people as you can. So at the end of the day, any research, like any other sector, generating network is really, really important. And so in this episode, we just collided, you know, there was just a collision between the two projects. But in general, I would suggest people to, like, get out there, talk to people, reach out, ask for suggestions, because then these things then will always come back, will always help you out in the future.